Blind Nil Audio.
What did today's guest, poet and professor Caroline Randall Williams, say when I asked her to talk about money?
All of the things running through my head, the loudest one is, that's not polite.
I think many of us were taught that it's not polite to talk about money. But on today's episode of 50 Fires, we are going to be impolite. What's a good income when you have friends that make way more than you and friends that make way less than you? And if you're an artist, which is nobler, writing poetry or The Vampire Diaries?
They both matter to me a very great deal. I love something that's high drama, high camp.
Stick around for my conversation with Caroline Randall Williams today on 50 Fires. Greetings, Carl here. Back when I was a financial advisor, the main question I asked all of my clients often included just one simple word: why? Why do you spend what you spend? And why do you save what you save? Why do you invest your money and your time the way you do? It turns out that these are not easy questions to answer, because most of us haven't spent much time consciously thinking about it. But my guest today, Caroline Randall Williams, has. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and recovering financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Caroline Randall Williams. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. Look, I'm a simple kid from the hills in Utah. So to get a chance to talk to somebody who does as many things as well as Caroline was an absolute honor. She's a professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, an award-winning cookbook author, writer, and TV personality who has very intentionally built her professional life to support her life as a poet. She realized early on that her life could support her art and not the other way around. And as we talked, that felt to me like her perfect answer to my one-word question of why. So here's my conversation about money and meaning with Caroline Randall Williams. Enjoy. Money and meaning, just what does money mean to you?
The first words that came to me were like safety and security. And then I think it's funny, I love writing poetry, but you know, I've had the opportunity, I met, not in person, but it's during the pandemic, but I was introduced virtually to Julie Plec, who is the creator of the TV show The Vampire Diaries. And Julie Plec and the writers of that show, it's not poetry, but it's probably done more for my life and more for the lives of many other people. That writing and the scripts and the story arcs of that show have done more to bring me peace of mind or joy or delivery from what was going on in my life than almost anything but Shakespeare, you know? So I think and they get compensated way better than my poems do. And so then it's sort of sometimes you think you're doing the noble thing by making no money and making this art that is sort of critically more valuable. But then I'm maybe the good art just does make big bucks, because what is good art? Does the good art, is it good because it's serious and complicated, or is it good because it offers catharsis and is fun? And the best stuff is both. I love The Godfather is both, right? Or Lady Gaga is both, right. Beyonce is both, Prince is both, Michael Jackson is both, Shakespeare is both, Lil Wayne is both.
Shakespeare and Lil Wayne.
I teach them often together. I do.
Shakespeare is one of your invites to your dinner.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Shakespeare's my...
And I think it was Lil Wayne.
And Lil Wayne. Yeah. They both matter to me a very great deal. Yeah. My favorite movie is Gladiator. I love something that's high drama, high camp, super pop culturally relevant, but also...
A righteous trick.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I think I've been reorienting. You asked me this as I literally was writing in my journal about this on the flight up here about... what does money mean to me relative to my own art because like I have sort of deliberately not sought money over trying to like write good poems, right? And I've said, okay, well, the poems are, I'm teaching to make money so that I can write the poems I want to write without worrying about the money. There, I'm sort of moving into a chapter in my life where I'm like, what do I need to be writing that's actually going to reach enough people that I know that I'm lifting them and soothing them and like bringing them pleasure on a larger scale in the day to day? You know, because my mother, you know, X's and O's, she had one top 10 charting country song, and one, I'm sure it paid for some huge amount of my private school, one song, right? And it's not even 3 minutes long. You know, and Trish Yearwood sings it, and it's brought so many people so much joy, yeah, including myself for so many years. And I'm like,
what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Right.
And
right.
So I think, so I'm just thinking, right. I've been thinking a lot about that, but money, safety, security, and what's it got to do with art?
What's it got to do with art is something I could spend, we could spend hours on.
Yeah. But like the question of like money and success are two
good
different
luck.
Things,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And especially yeah. relative to art, right? Like I've definitely experienced some scales of success that I had hoped I would by this age, but I've not made remotely the kind of money I hoped I would by this age. Like it isn't, the money and the success don't, they don't translate one to the other necessarily. I mean, and I think that that's an age old, you know, it's like F. Scott Fitzgerald was writing, it's like a pen for hire in Hollywood by the end of his career, even though he had, you know, written at least two, like at least one great American novel, you know, and then whereas Hemingway figured out how to make money off of his books. Like, I mean, it's just, it's interesting to see, some of it is also how you live, but some of it is that sometimes like you just have bad deals or, you know, I think it's interesting figuring out the success relative to the money.
It's amazing.
Can I tell you a really random story?
Please.
It's not apropos of nothing, but so I went to boarding school in New Hampshire. And I was like the Southern girl and I was black and there were like a lot of things were different about me, but I also like had grown up going to Martha's Vineyard and whatever. I wasn't like utterly a fish out of water or anything. But one of the most mortifying exchanges of my life, there was this girl whose name I won't name, but she came in as a sophomore and she and I were hanging out and her family were like tremendously wealthy and had this massive home in Palm Beach. It was like an estate. It was like one of these like palatial on the water things. And she was showing pictures of it. And she was like really irreverent about talking about money because she'd been the really rich girl at public school in New Hampshire and had no problem spending or talking about it to some people. But she was talking to me about how much the house might be selling for. And she was telling me these massive numbers. I was like trying to get my head around. And then 2 weeks later, I'm in her dorm room and these two other girls, one from an uber waspy family in Maine and the other one who was half WASP, half Jewish, but the equivalent, right? So I knew that these two girls were like that, but I figured, oh, well, they're friends with this other girl, so they know that that's how we talk about things. Then the girl who had the house in Palm Beach, she goes, the house sold. And the girls are like, oh, that's great. Like, your parents must be so happy. And I was like, how much did it sell for? And the two other girls, the WASPy one, they were like, oh, what kind of question is that? Like, that's so gross of you, Caroline.
Wow.
And I was flabbergasted, but also unsurprised. But I knew I'd broken a rule, but I'd broken a rule that I thought I was in a group where you could break that rule.
Yeah.
And what I also realized is that girl talked to me about money in a way that she didn't talk to those other girls. And now I look back to those other girls in a way that is probably part of the reason that she was willing to talk to me about it in the first place. I mean, I still grapple with it.
What do you make of it now? Like looking back on it?
Well, I think that there's money and then there's class.
Mm.
And this girl who was talking about her grandmother's house, I was sort of refreshed that I thought she was this sort of socially high class person, but who didn't mind talking about the right. financial wealth part. And so I guess what I make of it now is I was in the right to ask the question because of the context and that I should have stuck up for myself. She told me that they were selling it. Why couldn't I ask that question? Because these girls, what was behind it, your parents must be so happy. They knew how nice that house was. They knew that that means that the family is now in this wonderful financial situation.
But let's not put a number on it.
Yeah, exactly. But that's a place of privilege, isn't it? You know, I studied abroad in England and, you know, I have friends who are aristocrats straight up with titles and they're broke, but they're the most refined people and they get to move in certain circles that people who are the children of millionaires from Arkansas could never keep up with or be invited to share space Right. And so to me, money and class are two distinct things, because if you think about where all the terrible and some of the wonderful social idioms that we have in the United States come from, it's, you know, they're from England.
Right.
And like, if you're born a duke, but two grandfathers ago, somebody squandered everything.
Right.
But you still have the castle and you don't want to tell anyone. You know, it's like, we don't talk about the money because the money isn't the point. The title is the point.
Were you aware when you went to that boarding school, were you aware of what social class you were in? Like, were you aware then?
I don't even know if I know now.
Right. Right.
I mean, social class wise, I'm certainly like a plutocrat, right? Like, I'm second generation Harvard, well educated. My friends all went to great schools and have fancy jobs. But there's also the whole legacy black family narrative thing, like the downtown campus of Tennessee State University is named after my grandfather. Like, you know, as far as being a black person in the South goes, I'm very well situated socially. And then—
Hey, Carl here. Just real quick, Caroline's family history is so rich. Her grandfather, the one she just mentioned, is Avon Williams. He was a prominent Nashville lawyer and key leader of the city's civil rights movement. In fact, the downtown campus of Tennessee State University that she also mentioned was named after him. And his father, Arna Bontemps, was an African-American poet, a novelist, and noted member of the Harlem Renaissance.
Right. But then I get to New Hampshire and people are sort of like, well, I guess I can Google some of her family members. There was researchable context for me. And in the same way that there were kids in my prep school whose last names were like in many of the lines of history, of American history and history abroad. And so in that way, I felt very situated with them. But then on the other side, it's like, no, like we don't have a estate in the Hamptons for the summer or whatever. But that is a money question to some degree, not a social class. So I definitely was displaced in so many different directions. It's part of why I've made such a study of this in my own thinking.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm black in Southern spaces. I'm Southern in Northern spaces. I'm a woman in patriarchal spaces. Like, I live in a lot of intersections.
50 Fires will be right back. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome back to 50 Fires.
Were you taught to talk about money?
I probably should say all of the things running through my head, the loudest one is that's not polite.
The polite thing, that's, well, you don't speak about money.
Right.
I know politics is a different, maybe a different discussion in your family at least.
Yeah.
Money, politics, sex, and religion, we don't talk about in polite companies. Do you remember being raised that way? Like that's something that popped into your head?
Well, I think that what popped into my head is that I know that there are a lot of people in my life who would find it distasteful if I characterized any way that they brought me up in such a way that we were talking about money. I had a very intersectional upbringing because on the one side, there's a certain kind of black subculture that emulates some of the most complicated parts of upper class white society. And on the one side, you have that. But on the other side, like my grandpa was, I mean, he wasn't a gangster, but he wasn't not a gangster in Detroit.
I'm not going to say he was a gangster.
I mean, he owned a laundry service, but none of his friends had legal jobs. And so,
Carl, again, just to clarify, Caroline is talking about a different grandfather than the one we were talking about before. This one's paternal.
Jobs. And so, like, I mean, so he had a dry cleaner. So I'm like, were you literally money laundering or what?
Wow.
You know? So on that side of the family, my grandfather was make it, spend it, live your life. That dynamic.
Did you hear that from him or you just saw it?
I heard it from everybody. He died when I was 8, but from the limited encounters I had with him when I was little, and then the way that my mom talks about him, the way that his siblings talked about him, the way that like his friend, I mean, that's how he is remembered. And so there's that part. And then on the other side, again, like my godparents who really had a really big hand in raising me, my godfather worked at Goldman Sachs for a long time. And so obviously money was his job in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it sort of from like the intellectual perspective, it's not like wrong to talk about it when you're talking about investment banking versus
like the calculator,
who's rich and who's not and all of that stuff. So it was talked about and not talked about. And, you know, my mom was a writer and she's very successful, but, you know, the arcs of an artist's life are definitely still feast and famine, you know? And so there'd be moments when it'd be like, well, we're on a budget. Then there'd be moments when like she'd sell a book or a song would do well.
Do you remember those? Like, are you just remembering this in hindsight? Or do you remember at the time being like, oh.
I'm thinking of this one shopping spree. There was this store called, I think it still exists in Nashville called Posh, but back then it was the cool store where you could get all of the clothes that now the Gen Z or Generation Alpha are like dressing like. I used to think of bell bottoms. These kids think of the stuff I wore in middle school.
Right.
I remember mom taking me there, and I remember it coinciding with like a chapter of life when she was having some big professional success. I could probably say for sure that in that instance, it wasn't like mom's made a lot of money, so we're going on a big shopping spree, but it was a celebration thing.
Yeah.
And then like the one time we actually did talk about it was when her first book came out. There was a lawsuit about it. It was my mother wrote the black retelling of Gone with the Wind called The Wind Done Gone. And she was in court for like a year. Margaret Mitchell's estate sued her, all of this stuff, which was in some ways the best thing that could have happened in the book. It put her on the New York Times bestseller unless she stayed there for a while because it was like such a to-do. But she also won this really important award called the Free Spirit Award, which is highly publicized. And it comes with, it's like a $250,000 award or something like that. And I knew that she won that award, and then she bought our house. So I was very hyper-conscious of that. Like, when you make big money, you buy important things.
Right.
So
right.
I didn't learn that part, but yeah. I have a lot of artist friends. I mean, I've been very lucky to be raised in Nashville among people who have made a profound success of themselves by their voice, by what they can do with a guitar, with a piano, and they don't have to do anything but make music. But I'm a poet. Most of my poet friends have to do something else besides write poems. Whether it's teach at university level if we're lucky, or just do something else altogether, right? And I think one of the interesting things that I learned about money growing up is in like the artist class to some degree, is that I teach at Vanderbilt and that pays the bulk of my bills. It's my insurance, it's all that stuff. And I get to do that because I'm an artist, but then I also, because I am able to secure that money, I can also stay a poet. I don't have to give it up. And I think there's something interesting about learning where you need to find stable money relative to like eat what you kill money. Like, how much do you actually need? And if I can't make $1 million a year as an artist and I just need to go be a lawyer, no. Like, I can be a professor and also a poet and make a totally reasonable living that way. But I sort of cobbled that realization together myself about like how you combine a practical calling with a creative one.
Yeah, I think a lot about that. And I get asked that question all the time. Like, what's the role of a passion?
Yeah.
Like these lumpy incomes, and you reference that with your mom even, mm-hmm. like these book incomes and then there's nothing and mm-hmm. then there's this. And then, and the inability for you to find a place to have that conversation, because most people are like, I got a thing. If I stay here for 10 more years, especially a generation ago, if I stay here for 10 or 20 years, I'll have a pension.
Yeah.
And all of that's been torn from under, like most of us, we've moved from collective systems to individual systems.
Right.
And that's left this thing even more exposed, and there's still no conversation about it. So like, what, how did you make sense of it, I guess is what I'm asking. Because you said you had to cobble it together yourself. Like, walk me through some of that.
I got my MFA, and I was so lucky. I got a job that was like potentially tenure track at a university, and I landed with two really brilliant nonfiction writers who were a married couple, and they had both sort of written these mega books, and then they had sort of had a daughter and realized, like, we need this stability, and we're going to come and teach, and we're going to like intentionally seek out these full-time teaching gigs. And here I am, 26, 27, going, at the time I was like, I'm going to teach for a minute, but then I'm going to figure out how to like live by my pen. And then to watch them have lived by the pen and then come to this is like the safety from which you can then also go out and write. I was like, okay, maybe I need to look at this differently. And then I started thinking about like, okay, well, so then if I really want to be a full-time writer, but also a very competent and successful professor, like how do I set up my week, my day, my year to like do this for as long as I can, right? And then and not have it feel. And so like, for example, right now, like my classes at Vanderbilt, I teach two seminar style courses that meet one day a week each. I only teach on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So yeah, I have like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday for art, for traveling, or you know, and I feel like it makes the creative life sustainable. Like if you can't make art when you get 4 days off, you know, like I got to keep on. Right. I mean, and even then it is still hard for me because sometimes I have to walk around my house in my pajamas, like drinking wine and yelling for 3 days before I can write one sentence. I wish that I wasn't like that, but that, is me. But watching them come to like the thing that I thought I was like starting, but then going to, I was like, okay, I just need to rethink this.
Super.
And my mother's also done that. My mom has made millions of dollars writing books and country songs. And she's like, thank God for the stability of the academy. And you know, and, like the academy is not the be all and end all, certainly not for every artist. And like, there's so many questions about what is liberal arts education for anymore and all of that. But I know for those of us who actually love to teach and we're not working in genres where they're obviously gonna make seismic impacts on your bank account in the day to day, like having the opportunity to be in some ways like protected and or undergirded by like an institution that's going to organize all that other shit for you.
Yeah.
So that you can teach, but then also go out and write. That's been really valuable.
Which is largely the point of tenure. And, you know, like we want to make sure that this contribution to society is able to continue to happen.
Yeah.
Tell me, teaching reminded me of your experience in Mississippi. What did you learn about money there?
Whoa. You know, I finished college and I wasn't ready to go pursue an MFA. And so I went to Teach for America, and where I taught in Sunflower County, rural Mississippi. Like I think 99% of my students were on free and reduced lunch, and the majority lived at or below the poverty line. And so my first year of Teach for America, I made $31,500 a year before tax. Basically a little less than $2,000 a month. And I spent like $500 a month on gas, $500 or $600 a month on gas. And then my rent was enough that again. And I remember thinking, oh, like I want to go visit my friends in New York, because all my other friends from college were like working in investment banks. And I was like, if I spend $600 on a plane ticket, I don't know if I can afford groceries. So I was like, I was really having to figure out how to budget, or if I was like, okay, I'm going to buy this plane ticket and I have to like save up for it in advance in a way that was very nickel and diming. And then there was the other side of it, that the cost of living down there was still so much less that you actually could figure out how to live on that.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be just like grown normal men thought it was like, it wasn't even begging. Like they'd be like, hey baby, let me hold $10 for this gasoline. I'll take you on a date. So it was like a whole different level of people not having enough.
How did you deal with, and how do you still deal with your spot? And there's always people with more and there are always people with less, but you've seen a lot of both.
So, you know, on the relativity continuum, like when I was making 31,500, and there are so many other factors to consider in that, comparing myself to somebody's asked me for $10 versus my $31,500 a year. But like, you know, even within the construct of the like well-to-do family that I come from, like I was by, I think, probably a meaningful proportion, one of the less privileged financially of my friends and my friend group at college and at boarding school. Like my friends all came from, or a lot of my friends came from pretty profound wealth and like more than one generation of it, you know, eight-figure trust funds, right? When I think about that, I think the gulf between my wealth and their wealth is much larger than the gulf between me and the dude in the gas station in Mississippi financially.
Yeah.
And so on the scale, I've sort of lived on the financial totem pole within the societies that I've inhabited. So what to do with meaningful amounts of money when you get them? I live in like this very funny in-between space of, you know, I've inherited some money, but it's nothing like the kind of money that my other friends who have inherited money have. I have friends who can live off of the money that they've inherited without touching the principal, you know? Yeah. Like they can like whole send their children to school and like do stuff like that. I don't have that kind of money. And then it's funny, my husband comes from rural Kansas and from nothing. And he looks at what I have and goes, why don't you like invest it in this and that and the other? And I'm like, because it's tiny and precious to me. And he's like, tiny, what are you talking about? Like to me, it's like, this must be very carefully, like I would put it in bonds, I'd put it in cash under a mattress. So it's really interesting that in between of like, how do you, and then, and even I'm uncomfortable. I'm like, does it sound awful that I'm talking about this money that I have as though it's little when it's not, or is it embarrassing for me to think it's a lot when it's little? Like, I don't even know where it lands.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been thinking a lot since I got married, like, what do I do with it? How do I make it? Where do I turn to learn how to make it work well? Because I can't talk about it with anyone.
Yeah, this comes up every single conversation of this, like, how do I sort this out? I don't know the continuum. How do I make sense of it? And who do I talk to? So interesting. How would you define enough personally?
Enough for me would be if I felt like I could adequately take care of the people in my family that are moving out of working into not working because they're older. Like I want to be able to, I want my grandma to have live-in help and not have that be a strain on her or my family as she ages. I don't want her to have to move out of her house. And I'd be rich enough to like put a little apartment for someone to live and help her and pay that person a fair wage. And I want to one day be able to do the same thing for my mother. I want to be able to make decisions about where my children go to school without compromising the quality of life for any of the members of our family. And I would like to be able to, the things that I have, I'd like to maintain them without strain. My life is plenty fancy and wonderful. Like one of my biggest actual luxury, and I will put a number on it. My mom got me as a huge present for my 21st birthday, I think, a pair of Chanel ballet flats. They were, at the time they were like $490 or something. They're now, I don't know, inflation, whatever. Right, they're $900 for these shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I buy a new pair every year and a half or so. And my husband's dog has eaten.
Oh, no.
Ate a pair last summer and this summer.
His dog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's our dog now.
I was just noticing this, when it eats the shoes,
and
it's
I was
his
like,
dog,
I want to be able to replace that and be annoyed, but not have it be like a meaningful dent in the monthly budget.
Yeah, I have somebody, somebody told me that I want to be able to buy whatever kind of cheese I want and not feel guilty.
That,
like, it was just a really simple thing.
I just want to be able to take care of the things I already have. Replace them when they need replacing. Keep everything. I don't want deferred maintenance in my house. Like if I need a new roof, I want to put it on. If I need landscaping done, I want to pay for it. Like I just want to be able to keep up the things I have and take care of the people for whom I'm responsible. And I want to be confident that I am not going to have a weird old age.
Yeah. 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 I don't know about the how much money it would take to be confident about the weird part. But
I guess it's
a comfortable,
it's a old, comfortable age. Old age. I want to have an old age that is on my terms.
Yeah. Let's pretend 35 years from now, I'm still doing this. And one of your children comes to talk with me. How would you hope they would answer that question? What does money mean?
I can tell you what I hope that they know to say when you ask them, what did you learn about money in your house growing up? And I would hope that my kids would say, I learned to budget. I learned not to be afraid of money. And I learned how to make choices informed by it, but not governed by it. And I learned that my parents would have my back on my enterprises, even if they don't make money, as long as I had a clear vision. Like if my kid, you know, wants to just keep staying in school and doesn't want to have a job on the side, I hope that I can pay for them to stay in school and not have to have a job so they can like study butterflies or whatever. They still, they have to be a professor after that, right? But I like, or, you know, if they start a really cool business, I want to be able to help them have the startup for that. I don't want them to be afraid of starting it for financial resource questions. So that's what I hope for my kids, is that they feel confident and competent about how to manage money and how to make choices relative to money.
All I can say, Caroline, is amen. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was incredible. We at some point it would be really fun to go deep on what does money and art mean.
Oh my God, I would love to talk about that. Yeah. Let me make some more money with my art first.
That was amazing.
Yay.
I cannot stop thinking about the story Caroline told right at the beginning of our conversation. The tension and the confusion she felt from the way the other girls reacted with horror and maybe even disdain when she dared asked how much their classmates' house had sold for. In fact, it reminded me of an experience that I had, but I had forgotten about. When my wife and I were first married, we were out on a walk in our neighborhood, and one of our neighbors had recently sold their house. The sign was still in the yard, but it had the sold sticker, and he happened to be outside, and I made the mistake of asking him how much he had sold the house for. He just simply looked at me with a very similar response to what Caroline got. He said, "That's not something I talk about." I remember walking away with a mixture of shame and guilt, like I had broken some unwritten rule that everybody else was aware of. Do you remember ever feeling like that? What would you have done when my neighbor told me that wasn't a question I was supposed to ask? What does it say about the power that money creates in our society? These are complex emotional reactions, and it's why I love doing this podcast. It's why I love having you come along with me, because we have to change that. If we're gonna change the way we react with money and the way we react to each other relating to money, it's gonna take all of us. So thanks for being here, my friends. Cheers, until next time. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio. If you find this show valuable, would you do me a favor? Share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.